This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
When I met Adam Green, I knew he was a very special kind of weirdo. It would have been early 2001. Adam was just 19 at the time, and undoubtedly wearing either a sailor uniform or a Peter Pan costume he'd made, and performing with his band, the Moldy Peaches, around town in NYC. We've become dear friends in the years since then, and he's been a fascinating person and artist to observe up close. In the past decade, he hasn't been putting out as much proper solo music, but he's been doing all sorts of other interesting things, including, for instance, adapting Aladdin into an ambitious film project involving a lot of papier-mâché and a lot of very cool special guests. He also did an iPhone-only movie called The Wrong Ferrari that is trippy as hell. Adam is trippy as hell, but it was interesting to get to talk to him about how he regards his songwriting process as being a way to translate some of those trippy-as-hell urges that are uniquely his own. Also, this episode features an interview with Jennifer Herrema of Royal Trucks, speaking of weirdo heroes of mine. That'll come up in the later part of the episode. But first, a conversation with Adam that we recorded just a little bit earlier this summer. His new album, Engines of Paradise, is awesome, perhaps his best. It'll be accompanied by the graphic novel War in Paradise, and arriving in early September on Danger Mouse's 30th Century Records. And I just also want to mention that we recorded this just long enough ago that David Berman of Silver Jews and Purple Mountains had not yet passed away. So you'll hear us reference Berman as though, oh my God, it's so sad, but as though he's still alive. So I kind of apologize for that in advance, but it is also sort of interesting. Anyway, where we begin here with Adam, he's gotten really obsessed with perfumes and colognes in recent years, and I wanted an update on that from the jump. So let's get into it. Are you still on your quest to figure out what David Bowie allegedly wore?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to ask Iman.
Right.
You know, I mean, if anyone knows, maybe like she could tell us what David Bowie wore because, to backtrack so the people who are listening,
yeah.
It's like, so I got into this world of perfumes, and the way I got into it was originally because Albert from The Strokes, who's a friend of ours, he went, the Strokes played a concert with David Bowie or something, or maybe he was backstage in the dressing room, or for some reason, to me, this happens at Roseland. That's like the memory.
Right.
They're in the dressing room of Roseland. I'm not even there.
I think he might have gone to see them play.
He just saw them play.
Yeah,
okay.
I think he might have gone to see them play. I hope I'm remembering that correctly.
Yeah, so I'm paraphrasing this story, but it's not really a story. It's just that he was backstage and Albert gives him a hug or something and is struck by his smell, and he said that he was the best smelling person that he'd ever smelled in his entire life.
And trust me, Albert smelled some people.
He smelled people. He knows about the finer things. And anyways, this story was that could have just like been left alone, but the story was corroborated. Corroborated?
Corroborated
by a lot of other people. And when he died, like the Arcade Fire and different people were like giving interviews, and they were saying, by the way, you know, the way that David Bowie smelled is like the most distinctive thing about, you know, that he was incredibly.
Right. Yeah, a thing you notice if you meet him, you notice it, sort of.
Exactly.
Right.
You know, so then I was like, well, why doesn't anyone know what it was? And a few of the people said that it was Silver Mountain Water, which is like a really expensive fragrance. I don't think, based on the description I heard about it, that it was Silver Mountain Water that he was wearing, that Albert smelled on him.
Right.
But that was maybe something that he wore. I think he wore a lot of things.
Right.
You know, he said apparently he wore the fragrance called Minotaure, which is kind of like a sandalwood citrus smell, kind of like a creamy, like citrusy sandalwood. But I don't think that that sounds like what this was, because apparently, like in the description you read, I think it's the Arcade Fire said it, it was very smoky.
I mean, and you've gotten really good at like at figuring out what smells like, because you were already interested in fragrances a little bit before this particular tangent of it.
Yeah, I was interested in, I'm interested in like everything a little bit, you know, and this is just one thing I'm interested in, but you know what
this
I mean?
This is like one thing you're interested in a lot. I might just tell listeners, as I say, last time I was here, I got to smell some of the fragrances that may or may not have been what David Bowie wore, and there are many of them that Adam has collected in drawers in
right.
his bathroom, because you are fascinated by this.
Definitely.
And it smells wonderful in here, right here in your
thanks.
Home, as a result of proximity to many scents David Bowie might have worn.
Who knows?
You say that you are interested a little bit in a lot of things, which I think is an understatement. You seem to tend to be kind of immersive more than, you know, a lot of people when you are interested in something. I wonder, what was the first thing as a kid that you felt like nerded out on?
Yeah, you know, maybe like computers, or I was into like trying to learn how to program like computers, and like this computer language called Turbo Pascal.
Okay.
And Basic, which is like an early computer language, and you know, video games and stuff.
How old were you when you got into that?
Maybe like, I don't know, like 11 or 12.
Okay.
And then, you know, indie rock, of course. But the thing is that it was pretty much since I've been out of high school, I've been, you know, I was touring with the Moldy Peaches after like a year or two. So I didn't go to, you know, I didn't have an education other than the one that I learned how to teach myself. So I kind of learned how to teach myself stuff. And that, I think that's sort of the, it's almost like when they describe that, what is that kind of, that school, Montessori.
Okay.
I feel like I kind of gave myself my own Montessori education or
right.
something.
You're like an autodidact.
Yeah, something like that. You know?
Yeah.
But you know, the way I do it is I get interested in something like, let's just say like Cy Twombly or something. I like Cy Twombly. So I read a book about Cy Twombly. Then I'll take a bunch of notes about all the paintings, all the references in the paintings, because there's a lot of words. So then like from those paintings, I'll have all these different strings of thought references, and I'll research each one. And then, like, you know, maybe I'll read a book about that one sentence, or I'll just go through it. And then by the end of it, I'll know, like, about the history of Rome because of my connection to his painting. So I just branch off that thing.
Wow.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And same with the reason why I know about perfume is only because I was interested in a tangential anecdote about David Bowie. That, you
right.
know what I mean? But that I connected all my knowledge to that one anecdote.
Right. But what was the thing when it came to music and the initial spark with music? What was the what was the hook?
Nirvana and Beck.
Yeah.
That was probably my biggest things.
And you were probably just like, you probably saw Loser on MTV or something, yeah?
Yeah. I'm trying to think. I remember people telling me about Beck or not understanding.
Because you would have been just like in your early teens or something, right?
Yeah, it was just something that I heard it through a friend, and then for whatever reason, I can't remember. I think I really got into that album, One Foot in the Grave,
right?
Which was kind of like showed me about, from there kind of got to traditional American folk music. Like I kind of started to see that there was these references to old folk songs on that record.
Right.
Then I'd like, you know, research that and get to like Mississippi John Hurt or
right.
kind of older Skip James, I think, is referenced on that. Older things, I think Robert Johnson.
Yeah.
But then from there, you know, it was honestly for me, Beck was a multiple thing because he kept on like progressing as an artist. I mean, Kurt Cobain, you know, had died, so he wasn't really like a working artist.
Yeah.
But from there, like I got to see like when he made Mutations, which was, I think I was right when I was
yeah.
right when I left high school.
But the Beck thing was more of a thing where you started to see music is something you might do through
sure,
appreciating.
Yeah. Yeah, it was through like probably hearing his music was my own decision to become an artist.
Right.
Because
and so did you go get a guitar or what?
I had some friends in middle school and they played guitar and they had a guitar and like, you know, I was just messing around playing with like one finger and
like a slide.
Yeah, but yeah. Super determined to somehow even write like a song with one finger.
Did you write a song with one finger?
I did. It was pretty bad. Something about incestuous grandparents or something. But it was...
sounds about...
Yeah, it was pretty good.
Adam Greeny.
But I was doing it with one finger, and my friends had a band called Death Chickens. That was their joke band. But I was so enthusiastic to start a band that I like kind of co-opted this band. You know, and my enthusiasm like was more than theirs.
Right.
To the point where like my whole life was about our band Death Chickens that I was never even in.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I'm like making shirts.
They're like, Adam.
Yeah, they're like, you're not even in the band.
Yeah.
It's not real.
Well, that's like, I feel like people have said, because I didn't, you know, I played piano as a kid, but it wasn't like I was never going to join a band, like, that, you know, in high school. It was never a thing that might have happened. So I can't relate to this, but it is interesting how people tell me, like, your first band like that, it's more like just, it's just like a thing you make up that's not real. And yeah. It's like an excuse to, you just call, it's like a name for your peer group. It's not like a real band.
Yeah, it's like something to draw on the paper when your English teacher's talking, you know? You have to make up a logo.
Death Chickens.
Yeah, Death Chickens, like, you know, all this stuff. Like, I think the logo was something like the Dead Kennedys, but it was just a D and a C.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
You know, and there was no songs or anything.
Oh my God.
But anyways, but then from that, you know, my next band was the Moldy Peaches.
Yeah, and Kimia is older than you, and was she your babysitter, or is that sort of an exaggeration?
Yeah, it's a bit of an embellishment. It's not totally untrue. I mean,
right.
Kimia is a lot older than me. Like, people don't realize because she's like looks so young, but she's 9 years older than me.
Okay.
So when I was maybe like 12 years old and I met Kimia, she was 21.
Right.
You know, now she's like, Kimia's like, her parents owned a daycare center and she grew up around kids. So she kind of just knows how to hang with a kid.
Yeah.
And she was working at a record store. Maybe I was a little older than 12. You know, maybe I was like, it was my first job. I was like a pizza.
Okay. So probably 14 or so.
Yeah. Something like that. Yeah. So she's a... She was working at the record store, and I was working at the pizza as like a wipe down table boy. I met her at the art center because she was like reading her poetry at this open mic, and I was playing guitar. And so I came into the record store, and she's like, "Oh, are you that kid that was at the open mic?"
Yeah.
I mean, this open mic, by the way, was like a sad goth girl poetry night. Like I was probably the only boy at the poetry. Reading.
Yeah.
But I was playing these sad songs I wrote.
Right. Not for Death Chickens.
And Kimmy was reading some sad poetry that she wrote.
Right.
You know what I mean? It was all very sad.
Yeah. It was sad on every imaginable level. So, picture it sad.
But you know, so I remember like I'd have a lunch break and I used to bring you know, like those like kind of China markers, like, you know, they call them China markers. They're like these sort of like grease pencils that I think you can write on glass with them.
Oh yeah, okay.
Like that was like, I just remember having that pencil and it had like a little string and you could like pull the string and make the point longer.
Right.
And so I had like one of those yellow legal pads. I would bring it over and we would like with this kind of crayon like write these songs. And I would sit on like a milk crate.
At the record store.
Because they kept their records in milk crates.
Right.
And you know what I mean? And like, and yeah, we just sit there and try to write songs. And we wrote a few, and
yeah.
Then it was like, oh, you know, I have a 4-track at my house. Do you want to record them? And so Kimia like would come over to my house, and you know, my parents are like, oh, you know, you made this friend,
right?
You know, she's like a lot older,
right?
You know, she drove a car,
right?
And we started to record, and you know, and Kimia was writing, had like a little diary, and I was like, kind of would encourage her to, you know, make up stuff over guitar. And we just started kind of like making this game in the basement where we could like, you know, basically each have a piece of paper and try to write lyrics.
So she hadn't been doing all that much more like attempts at songwriting before that than you had either. She was still kind of new to. Still needed
I don't think that she had written songs.
Right.
I think that we just sort of like we started writing songs as a sort of like an activity. We wouldn't even really show each other like what we were working on. We would just both write, and then we would like you know, like when it came time, then we'd like each sing.
So how long were you doing that before it started to feel like, okay, wait, we're a band and we should play shows and stuff?
Oh, like a really long time.
Right.
Yeah, because like pretty much the Moldy Peaches is like my band throughout all of high school. But it's kind of like Death Chickens where like no one really knows that it's a band. Like we don't, it's not like we played shows.
Right.
Oh, okay, in regards to what you said about Kimmy being a babysitter, she was because, you know, as I was growing older, you know, we'd be like, oh, you know, the Makeup are playing a concert at Irving Plaza with like Dub Narcotic Sound System or like
damn,
whatever, you know,
good
like
show.
All these different things, you know, whatever. I don't remember who we were seeing, you know, yeah. Unwound, maybe like Sebado, like all different kinds of bands were playing. And I was still a little young to go into the East Village by myself. So
all
my
the way
parents
into the
were
city.
They'd be like, Kimya, like please take Adam and like here's the tickets, like here's the money for the tickets and like here's your train fare. Like, you know, she was like my chaperone, you know?
Oh, that's so nice.
Yeah, they were like so in a way, you know, she was sort of a babysitter, but...
And she was probably a little more able to you know, in the relationship, turn you on to the artists like that, you know, or was it a sort of... Because she was working at the record store,
yeah,
right?
Well, she knew some of these people. I mean, because she lived in Olympia, so
but when did you start wanting to play shows and having and starting to feel like doing music was a thing to devote more time to?
I kind of heard about that folk singers played open mics and that they hung out at coffee houses and stuff. Like, you know, you hear about it. Like, you know, those kind of places are probably where I did learn how to perform for people. You know, I mean, like there was Kimya had been going to Evergreen College in Washington. So she lived in, she had like a life out there. And so she moved to this town called Port Townsend, which is like a, like kind of hippie town, and she had a house, so she was like, "Oh, you know," and I wanted to escape New York, and so I took a Greyhound bus to Washington State, which is like a really long journey, to join Kimya, and yeah, we lived in a house together, and that was my first time.
That was after living alone. Were done with school.
Yeah. I was just like, I didn't know anything about living alone. I mean, you know, I was like the subject of ridicule because like I didn't know how to like plunge a toilet or like cook myself spaghetti or into anything. I was just like a little kid that like, you know, I mean, basically the only thing I knew how to do was, you know, use this four track.
Right. Yeah. But I mean, what 18-year-olds don't know how to do shit anyway.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
like
yeah.
Really like until you've been out on your own.
Exactly. Yeah. I just didn't know. I didn't live in a place and, you know, I never like written a check or done
had
anything.
You ever gone on a trip that long before that bus trip? Like, on your own?
Yeah, for some reason I made this tradition of I kept on going across the country in these trips. I did that voyage like maybe like six times. Like, you know, I kept on going back and forth.
Wow.
It was I liked it because I would like.
How many days does it take?
It takes about 3 days.
Okay, that's not so bad.
Yeah, it's I thought it was fun.
Yeah.
You know, you get to see America too. I hadn't seen the country, so for me it was like, holy shit, I'm in. Can I swear? I don't know.
Yeah,
holy crap. Holy cow. I'm in Iowa.
Right.
You know, I'm in North Dakota.
Right.
You know, these were really interesting things, like Wyoming. Like, I got to see all this stuff on the bus. You know, you meet crazy people, you know, really, 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 really twist.
Yeah.
Like, you wake up and people are, like, playing with your hair or, like... Yeah, it's like, it's a mess.
Yeah.
You know, or like, whatever, someone confesses that they're like a runaway criminal or something, you know, or like, you're like, okay.
Oh my God.
You know, every 6 hours or so, your seatmate changes, so you get like to meet a million people. It's
and
like
then
speed
you,
dating.
And then when you were out there in Washington, you guys would be working on music or?
Yeah, we were working on music. You know, just, that was probably when we first played our shows.
Right.
I think it was there was a coffee shop called the Boiler Room, and they had us play a concert, and we also played the American Legion Hall with Dub Narcotic Sound System. That was like at K Records, you know, the founders of K Records.
So
that was it. But that was it, you know. Then I got homesick and felt like lost and went back to New York, and luckily I found my way to the Sidewalk Cafe,
right,
which I did because I was playing the Subways. and somebody was like, oh, yeah, you know, there's this open mic at Sidewalk Cafe, and they said there was a folk scene. That was I called Kimmy and told her there's this amazing scene going on in New York, and you know, there's this open mic, and like everyone is, you know, really, really cool, like, and you know, people are writing these amazing songs, and you know, you got to come. And that was like all she needed to hear. She was like looking for an excuse to come back home. So they actually got a van, and they colored it peach colored, and all the whole Moldy Peaches band, which by that time had like we had a guitarist and a drummer, and
right,
they all came across the country in a peach colored van,
right.
And then we played our first band show at Sidewalk Cafe.
Right. And so is that the same? Did personnel change, or is it?
No, yeah, that was a different personnel.
That was an original Moldy Peaches lineup.
That lineup of the band ended up going back to Washington.
Right.
You know, and just Kimya stayed because she has like roots in New York.
How did you guys link up with Jack and Mertens and Toby and stuff?
I think it was just through, same thing, through Sidewalk Cafe.
Right.
Like, you know, we met. Jack was in a play called Thunderwear. Do you know about this play?
No.
So there's a play called Thunderwear that was written by Seth Hebert from Doofus.
Okay.
He was like incredible musician, like almost like, I mean, because people kind of compare him at the time to like Frank Zappa or something, but mm-hmm. he's just this super original songwriter that like, you know, he wrote this massive musical called Thunderwear, and it involved this huge amount of improvisation. Mm. And Jack Dishel was like, you know,
right.
like a shining star of this play.
Yeah,
and
friends.
he would perform, they did it at this kind of punk venue called Surf Reality. And Jack Dishel was like, you know, improvising every night. And they had these like amazing songs. And every night was different. So you like, you know, keep on going to see it. And I mean, honestly, it was the most ambitious like artwork that I'd ever seen in my life. You know,
yeah.
that was by someone my own age.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Or like of
that
my,
you'd met, yeah.
Yeah. And, just like blew me apart.
It wow.
Blew apart my mind. And so, yeah, so I met Jack, and then we met Toby, who else? Brent Cole and mm-hmm. Steven Mertens. Everyone, I think, through it was a huge amount of people that had gone to SUNY Purchase, like college,
mm-hmm.
that had ended up at.
Yeah, great art scene.
Yeah, because Toby went to SUNY Purchase,
right.
and Jeffrey Lewis went there, and Regina Spektor,
right.
Jack, Seth had gone there.
Right.
It's unbelievable the amount of people who went to SUNY Purchase.
Would you say that the demeanor that you have on stage now is the same? Like, have you always sort of, has your stage kind of, your physicality, the way you present on stage, has it sort of, is it the same as it's ever been, sort of, or did you have to kind of find a way to be yourself for a while first?
Well, you know, like, I think that, you know, I have anxieties in life, but for some reason when I actually get on stage and perform for people, I don't feel that nervous about it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I just kind of think, oh, it's going to go fine or something. Like, I don't think about it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And like, but before the show, sometimes I do. Like, I'm like, oh man, what if, like, what's going to happen to me? Like, what if it's, you know, I make a fool of myself. And then, you know, and then when it ends up happening, it's like, oh, that was fine. I guess once I'm actually out there, it's like, whatever.
Yeah.
But, so I do think that, that, you know, that you have to learn a little bit. Like, I mean, because probably if you add up all the shows that I played, it's maybe like 1,000 concerts or something.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, like, in that sense, like, you
but
learn
I mean,
a lot.
Even, I mean, right. But I mean, even like, well, first time I ever saw Moldy Peaches was opening for the Strokes at Mercury Lounge.
Right.
In 2000, early 2001, probably. You were wearing the
Robin Hood or Sailor.
Sailor. Kimya had a costume as
and
well.
Bunny?
Yes.
Rabbit.
And I, you know, genuinely had the thought, what the fuck is this? Which was followed very quickly by the thought, I fucking love this. But just like you as a kid, like you would have been maybe, what, 18 or
yeah.
something at that point. It was just like,
yeah,
this,
it wouldn't have been allowed in the bar.
Just, you just don't see that many kids that age who have that much of a confident sense of their own, what kind of weirdo they are at 18.
Right,
like,
right.
Most 18-year-olds are just sort of, like, trying so hard to be cool, and you were not trying to be cool at all. And that's how, I guess, you know,
yeah,
like, that's
yeah.
how you end up being cool, or whatever.
Well, you know, it's funny.
Are
I always had, like, a big diary, you know what I mean? Like,
mm-hmm.
a kind of a, I don't know how to explain it, like, it's, like, a almost, like, a lot of writing. Like, and I do, I just write, like, I write all the time. You know, I write like, I write a sentence every hour or two. You know what I mean? Like I have like an endless
holy
supply
shit.
Of stuff that I'm writing. You know what I mean? And I'm just in that process with myself. I think there's a certain amount of introspection involved in it. So like, since I've been pretty young, like I've been kind of, I don't know what you call it, having a little conversation with myself about like what I'm really thinking. And you know what I mean? And in that sense, like a lot of that kind of, you kind of try to pull it out and then you kind of look at it. And so in that way, I was kind of like a little bit introspective. I was introspective since I've been pretty young.
Mm. Wow. So this kind of set, you know, so it's a sentence that pops into your head. You like the sound of the words, the feel of the words, something about that sentence. You want to keep it and you write it down immediately.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, you know, if you look at like, I'll show you. Hold on. Can we go over here?
Yeah, we can.
Okay, here we have a mobile recording unit. Okay, so like,
this documentary style.
So this is like, these are stuff that I would write, you know, and so I just have, you know, lines.
Wow.
You know what I mean? And
holy shit! So this is a bound book, and how? And so this is the result of how much time does this document have? Like, do you think months and months of ideas?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, just sentences, you know, stuff I write down.
That kind of repository of stuff, is that just sort of the file for whether it's a graphic novel kind of thing or a song, or do you go to that same place?
Yeah, I would go to everything. There's like a hole in my brain, and it goes into these sentences, and then that's my scroll, and I have just a body of writing. And it's all, everything comes from it. The thing is that, like, once it's time for me to edit it, then I have, like, an editor self that goes in, like, and then it's kind of like being at a feast, and I, like, take all these different things, and I try to, like, you know, make them relate to
perfect plate.
I make them relate to the themes of the thing that I'm thinking about. You know, like, so, like, if I have a scene about, you know, like, someone rebellious talking to their father, you know, like I find like rebellious dialogue and I find like, you know, paternal dialogue or something. And I try to like, I try to take those different aspects of my personality. I find the person that does that and that, and then I have them like fight against each other.
Wow.
You know what I mean? Or like, you know, so there's an editor me that, but the editor me doesn't even really respects the writer me. Like the editor is like, the writer knew what he was doing. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I always feel like the editor part is like, doesn't want to change what the writer said. Just wants to find, like, rather than that, I'd like probably find a different line. Like, I assume that the writer wrote things exactly like how it should be.
And so has it been like that since you start? I mean, obviously you've described sort of how you and Kimia would collaborate separately and together and stuff like that. But is this kind of the process you've been using on your solo music ever since whatever Garfield, the first album, or
yeah, well, you know that, and also I just do a method where I'll walk around and sing. Like I just literally like make up the words as I'm singing. You know, which is probably the best way to write a song is you basically start making up words. You make up language. It's almost like you try to like let like a wave of a feeling like guide and. Emotion. You let the emotion guide the words into a melody, or you let the melody guide the emotion guide the melody into words. Mm-hmm. Or I don't know how to explain it. You try to like ride it until it like makes, you know. And then I assume that whatever gets caught up in that tornado is part of the thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like the thing is that it's actually, I mean, for better or worse, like I kind of feel like people are kind of like landscapes inside, or they're like there's like a kind of a. Like, I think that's kind of what abstract painting is like somebody's just trying to show you, like, the shape of the landscape that's inside of them. You know what I mean? And I feel like that's kind of like, for me, it's like, there's just so many things that I'm obsessed with that I think about. Like, they keep on repeating. Like, I've been having the same thoughts since I've been, like, 12 years old. And I just have, like, more nuanced versions of it. But I think they're basically, like, it's all, I'm just stuck with the same landscape. And it just, like, I keep on having to, like, rehash it. And I'm like, engines again? Dancing again, you know what I mean? Like, and I have like thousands of sentences that have the word engine in it, or dancing.
When you go through that book,
or time, or it's
like it must make you really hyper aware of the recurring thoughts when you have those phrases down on a page.
Well, it's kind of like, if you have like a modulating like a lock, And you know what I mean? You just keep on changing the one of the numbers.
Right.
I feel like that's what I'm doing a lot, is I just modulate the different words together until I find a combination that like unlocks a feeling to me, like it transports me.
Yeah. You know,
so it's almost like for me, I'm just looking for stuff that takes me to like another dimension. Like, I don't know what another dimension means, and I'm not saying it's another dimension, but I'm just saying, like,
yeah,
we as people.
Yeah, that's what music is another dimension, though.
I think
ultimately,
so.
Ultimately, well, it's not that you can't, it's not really in the same realm as other forms of communication. It requires so much more from the recipient.
Right.
But also, I'm always intrigued by not just the words side of things, but, like, you know, if you listen to artists, you hear whatever is like a melody that they can't resist, or it's like this series of notes that must feel really good to sing for them because in their catalog you hear it pop. And I'm always intrigued about that, where I'm just like, oh, the first time, what it must have felt like the first time your voice found that three note sequence
that you love
so much. It must have felt so good, or there's something so right about that sequence for your body that you can't resist it.
Yeah, exactly. And that anything that you can't resist becomes like the remnant that like the water imprint made from the cliff or whatever. Like, it becomes the erosion that you can't get rid of. You know, you have to keep it.
Yeah.
You know, and actually, I think it has something to do with like a hypnosis. Like, you know, because people, I think, you know, are walking around in like a hypnotized state largely. Like, you know, you're kind of like, you walk to work and you don't think about it. You just end up at work. You don't, you know, it's because you're basically hypnotized or something. But I think that for when I'm trying to actually make the lines up in my songs, I'm trying to give people like a feeling of going out of the hypnotized state for that one, for those particular lines. So so the other dimension for me is just only the unhypnotized state that I'm trying to show you what I feel like it feels like to not be hypnotized.
Right.
So I'm basically always chasing after unhypnotized language. And then from that, using it as a song, it's like an incantation or something. So it becomes like a magic spell. So then if you take all the unhypnotized text and then you say it to somebody while having them like hypnotized by the song, you're basically performing like some kind of emotional surgery on their soul that's unconscious. And so at the end of it, even though like maybe like they don't realize it, you have like done a little bit of like chiropractic work on their spirit. Do you know?
Wow. Yeah.
I mean, if they let you in, I guess.
Right. I'm intrigued thinking about your songs and the evolution of your songwriting, whether you feel like when you were younger, you used that opportunity more to shock, might be the wrong word, but to unsettle or unnerve,
right,
or be, you know, kind of crazier versus now. It feels like listening to your songs now, and you're older and more mature and you have a family and stuff, but
right,
it's more an opportunity for a more relatable chiropractic hypnotherapy.
Right.
Is that something that you're, I mean, yeah, do you feel like you've moved toward in the way that is still true to you, more personal, derived songwriting than, you know, just sort of this weird other world of things you're writing about?
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, I think they're always personal. I mean, like, I think that the actual method has always been kind of the same, where I've been like basically trying to make you know, like to take a kind of symbolic vocabulary that's sort of been somehow like infused in my being and sort of trying to like exercise it. And you know, when I was younger, for some reason it seemed so like important to have it be like super explicit. And but you know, maybe that just comes from that age and being that age, you know, like where, you know, like you know what I mean? It's like, if you want to describe something more nihilistic or like kind of punk, I mean, like, you know, like fucking 40-year-olds don't invent punk. You know what I mean? Like, they don't, that's not like an idea of a, you know what I mean? Like, it's like something like a kid does, you know what I mean? And when I was a kid, just like, I was like a little twerp, like everyone else. I was talking about this with Jack Dischel, you know, and a lot of that stuff at that time, like, certain kinds of gestures, I feel like, I wanted to kind of like force people to meet me on my own terms.
Mm-hmm.
So like part of, in a way, like almost testing or like hazing an audience till they'll like, you know, truly like meet you on your terms, because you're like, for some reason, like you know, punishing people so that they can learn the correct way to love you. Very much like daring people to dismiss it. It's funny because even though like a lot of my work is very private, and like, you know, I work pretty much uncensored, and I work from my own brain as just like a hole in my brain that I just try to pour out. You know what I mean? Like, it's actually something I do in collaboration with the world. I mean, like, a huge part of it is a collaboration I do with my wife. You know, like, she, you know, she goes through all my writing with me, and like, we, you know, make up stuff. Like, we wrote this comic book together that's coming out, The War in Paradise. We wrote the storyline together. Or, you know, she helped me to edit like Aladdin, the movie, and she produced it with me. You know, so a lot of it is very, it's actually pretty collaborative, but, you know, just amongst my friends mostly, you know.
Right. Like, well, then that's also that people who know how your brain works, who can help with clarity and, instead of trying to change it.
Yeah, yeah, maybe, yeah, like, yeah, exactly. Like, friends of who, like, or I trust or something, you know, they'll just, like, read stuff and be like, this is cool, this sucks, or whatever. And, you know, I just trust them. I'm not that precious about it usually. If I find myself being precious about it, I'm like, oh, this must be really important to me. I must keep it.
Yeah.
But mainly, I'm just like, oh, you know, I'll just, like, I don't know. But, so it is not just for me. I mean, or, like, I don't know. It's my relationship with the world, you know, as much as, like, I don't know, sometimes I feel like it's my main activity. It's like, I basically feel like I'm the collector of my own art or something, you know, like I'm the audience of my own music. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, but it's, I guess, yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, you probably long ago, if it ever conspicuously entered your mind to worry about that, reminded yourself that as an artist, you can't, that can't be part of the equation. I mean, I remember watching The Wrong Ferrari and thinking, as someone who had already known you a long time at that point,
right,
like, yes, if you want to look inside Adam's brain, that's what, at that era at least, that's what I think the inside of it looks like. And it may, you may not get it at all if you haven't, don't have any inkling about Adam.
Right, right,
but,
yeah, yeah.
But actually, no. I mean, it's the same thing as, I feel like Beck would probably say that One Foot in the Grave was as much of, like, something that seemed like just a weird look at his brain.
Right, right.
And yet, it was an album that inspired you tremendously, so.
Yeah, and Mutations. You know,
right.
For me, Mutations was really the moment where I heard it, and I was like, oh, I have to get a notebook right now and write down everything in my brain. Like, that was, like, the moment for me, because it just seemed like such a masterpiece, like, that I, you know what I mean? And I didn't know that people were, like, making masterpieces at that point in time.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, wow, this, you know, like, this is, like a really bold statement from this sort of, like, it's almost like this diamond this person's made, and, like, I have to, you know, it felt like somebody was made, like, a David Bowie album or a Bob Dylan album, but, like, they were just made it. Like, it was just came out today. You know what I mean? And so I, like, I, it was my, that was kind of my, like, I have to get moving and get going, you know, as an artist with that record probably.
Yeah. But nowadays, now that you have, you've developed all these other outlets, visual arts and films and whatever, it, you know, in these same several years as you haven't been putting out, like, a traditional Adam Green album until this new one, it must now feel like when you have weird ideas pop into your brain, like, there's a, you can actually execute things besides albums. It's
very
freeing.
Well, that's kind of like being a grown-up, right? It's like, I feel like when you're a kid, like, you know, like, let's say you, like, you take acid when you're 14 or something, you know, and then, like, you actually can't really do anything with that information. Like, you might get, like, a huge vision, but you don't necessarily know what to do. But, like, then maybe if you're 30 and you take acid and you have, like, an idea about building a geodesic dome, you can, like, build it.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So it's kind of just about growing older, and you just, like, you know, yeah, you have these kind of visions, and then you, for some reason, you actually are like, okay, well, if I really want to do it, I'll learn about architecture and I'll learn about how to do this. So that's kind of, I think, as I got older, I just, it's the same, maybe I had some of the same kind of ideas that I had when I was younger. I just now had the patience to execute them.
Right. Yeah. And I would imagine that being kind of, yeah, being...
Well, even with an iPhone movie, like Wrong Ferrari
is
an iPhone movie, right? I mean, so, like, I think that that's just something that I did when I was, I guess, right when I was turning 30, you know, but just, like, I think that that's just about discipline. Like, why would you take a bunch of iPhone footage and spend, like, whatever, you know, a good part of a year editing into a feature film? You know what I mean? It's just because, like, that's just, like, something I wouldn't have been able to do when I was 19 or something, you know?
Right. Well, or build an entire set of papier-mâché.
Right, right, yeah.
And do a wild recreation interpretation of Aladdin for that matter.
Well, yeah, and I had a lot of help with that.
So now that you're in the mode of getting ready to put out an album, and obviously it's exciting to have this album coming out, originally I know, like, a year ago it was an EP, and it's great that you recorded more. But now you're having to put your brain back into that kind of like more organized album cycle mode or whatever.
Yeah.
Are you starting the repository of next things to execute once you get out of that mode? Is that brewing already?
Usually I'm knees deep in something else by the time this stuff happens. Like, and in this case, I've spent the last like 9 months or writing a really like an epic poem about the medieval times. That's wow. Like, it's been like I'm really like, I got to say, I think it could spend another 6 months on it, because it's really like it's just coming together. But nice. But it's really, really cool. It's a very, and if you ever want to stop a conversation, you can say that you're writing a poem, because pretty much that's the end of all conversations. And the people who you're talking to, and you tell them that you're writing a poem, that they're always like, yeah, I'm never going to read that.
Well, an epic poem implies a greater workload.
It's a really, really, really it's a really cool poem that I'm working on. But yes, I've been working on that for a long time. And so, you know, that's something I want to do. I wanted to make like a Ninja Turtles movie, but it's really like taking a back seat. I don't know if you can make your own Ninja Turtles, but I'd like to.
With made with real turtles. 100% real turtles.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it would be the Ninja Turtle story is kind of about subculture. Like, I mean, I guess I feel like I'm part of a, right? I guess I grew up as part of a subculture. Like, I feel like the work I do is subcultural. Like, I mean, that's like, actually, what's funny is like, when I think about who like would listen to my music, I'm like, oh yeah, somebody who's really into subculture or something. But it's like, but it's funny, that feeling really remains. Sometimes I feel like I'm a subculture of one.
Well, that's being modest to a highly disparaging degree. But I think yes, you are a subcultural hero or that kind of thing. I think it's like cool though, in a moment when this year, you know, fantastic albums by people like Bill Callahan and David Berman more recently have been in the sort of critical dialogue of like, you know, new music as a reminder that.
Yeah, I saw that Berman's album was charting in the top 20 of Amazon, which is incredible. Because I didn't even know that stuff was like allowed entry into the law, like the law of the world anymore.
It also just goes to show that like the long tail of your influence when you are operating in the proudly in the subculture it's such a long the arc through time of like, you know,
right.
For whom your music might have been their Beck's Mutations. Like, it's, you can't see that from your vantage point, nor should you, because the things that you're making are part of what's great about them is that they're separate from the kind of audience that may influence them.
Right,
I mean, it
must have
been weird during that era when you're touring with the Strokes and they're fucking massive and you're playing weird ass music that's like definitely not going to be commercially like that.
Right.
But to still have a lot of attention and ass kissing happening because you're like on tour with the Strokes or whatever. I guess I'm curious from the realm of like, the mainstream culture and what an artist needs to do to be successful in the mainstream. Did you derive any important lessons that even in your unique way you apply to the albums you make or the shows that you put on? What did you learn? What have you learned from even just this, from touring, even just from the Strokes?
Oh, well, like, I mean, so much. I mean, basically, like, you know, way, like, I guess we I was kind of mentored by them or something. Like, is that the word?
Yeah.
Mentored. Yeah. Because they were such ambitious musicians, you know what I mean? And so to see them perform, I mean, you know, before I was talking about Seth Hebert's like Thunderwear, which is like one of the most ambitious art projects that I've ever seen, and then to see the Strokes and to, you know, to tour with them on their first, you know, tours, I was like, wow, this is actually like the most ambitious like rock band I've ever seen that's like my age. And you know, I kind of like got to see how they did it and just kind of informed my idea of like how to apply discipline to a creative endeavor.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And just in like lots of ways, just in every way, it like had a huge effect on me. Also, I think also, you know what? I think also like waking me up as far as like, you know, like this sort of idea of like the mask becoming the face or something. Like, you know, you kind of like have a mask and then you wear it and to the point where it becomes the face. And with the Strokes, it's like I got to see sort of like them start off as like kids and then like just end up just being legitimately like rock heroes or something. And I think, you know, maybe like even stuff like that I listened to at the time, like The Doors or like Rolling Stones or like Scott Walker or stuff that I thought, you know, I was like, oh, you know, that seems like that's from another world. I started to actually like try to, you know, it made me feel more comfortable try to incorporate those influences into my own artwork and be like, okay, well, you know, I can, it doesn't matter, like fake it till I make it. Like I'm Sinatra tonight, you know what I mean? Like I'll be like Frank Sinatra at this place and just like, you know what I mean? I'll just try it.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean? And then you fake it so much that at one point you like forget that you're faking it and you're just like, you just do it. And then it just becomes who you are. And then you like years later and you're like some crooner guy. Like I don't even... Yeah, you know, I don't remember like how it happened. You know what I mean? It's ridiculous, but that's what the world is, you know.
Oh my God! I think that's a good place for us to wrap up, Adam. Thank you so much.
Yeah, of course. Time. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Look for Adam's new album, Engines of Paradise, along with the graphic novel War in Paradise in early September, and he's going to be on the road extensively throughout the rest of this year. Up next in episode 32 of LSQ, a conversation with Royal Trucks' Jennifer Harima. I recorded this earlier in the year, around when Royal Trucks put out a new album called White Stuff. It's really a great return from them. And they were supposed to go on tour, but it all got foiled due to a combination of factors. But in a way, things falling apart just feels very apt for the kind of awesome Royal Trucks have always been. And so although they did not do the tour they had planned, Jennifer does have some shows coming up with Ariel Pink, who remixed some songs from that new album White Stuff for an upcoming EP called Pink Stuff that also arrives on September 6th. One of the things that intrigues me is just the instinctiveness of kind of what you do, and I'm intrigued thinking about returning to Royal Trucks and getting back into it, whether like how you kind of retained your instinctiveness about it without overthinking it, because obviously distance can make one overthink what something should be.
Well, yeah, this it's interesting. Because I feel like Royal Trucks was never, Neil and I, like, you know, meeting each other, you know, I was 15, he was 19, like, we were together all our lives, but we never were one person. Like, having grown up in the city, I feel like I'm 100 years old, like, I'm like, I mean, it's bad in a way, like, I kind of try to... I want to see everything new again, you know. So I'm like, let me smoke some more weed and check it out again. Like,
yeah.
But we really did like have our own. We came at things from a different place to begin with, but then we brought it all together. And then when we separated, I think that was also part of why I needed to separate. Cause I didn't like at coming in at such a young, I didn't want to lose myself. Like, and I could see myself kind of like, I was just like, I gotta bust out.
Yeah.
Just, like, and in doing so, I think I retained a lot more of myself. And I just did what I had been doing, but had been bringing to the collaborative effort. And, you know, Neil is such an amazing musician, just, and, you know, he's a great writer, but we do come from different places, completely different places. And I guess we're just so in tune because we met each other so young.
Right.
And we're with each other for so long. But I feel like that's, nothing really did change. Like, when I saw him for the first time, like, he walked right in this, like, we played down the block.
Oh, really?
That's where our reunion show was. I mean, how weird is that, too?
That's awesome.
No, I mean, that was just an accident. Like, Neil called me and he's like, do you want to do this? And I was like, completely shocked. Like, oh, really? Oh, really? But it was really good money, and he seemed really into it. I was like, of course. Walked in the door, and it was like I was standing in there, and in our studio in Virginia had a similar room like that with like a cathedral ceiling in there. It's kind of up.
Right.
It felt like I was just back in time. Like, it was just really, it was great. I mean, it was great. You know, but we still have the same stuff that was going on, you know, when I went my separate way, you know, we still butt heads and stuff, but that's what we always did that. Like, we don't for a period of time, like everything, we're like, when we were writing, it was just like, there was just no fighting, no, like, it just kind of went on a roll. And then it just, like, you know, it goes extreme. Like, I was like, he goes silent. And then I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to continue on. I'm not waiting here, right. You know?
And yeah. It is interesting. I've noticed the way that I've never been in a band, but the way that people who've been in bands together, kind of attachment that they have for each other that's dysfunctional often because there's so much shit there, so much history. Right. But it's like you just sort of realize you're stuck with the person.
Well, the thing...
In a way that's good and bad.
Right, you know? Exactly. But, you know, I didn't... Like, we were not, like, stuck... Like, it was 14 years before, like, there was any... He did, like, an email, like, twice to tell me that, like, the cats died. You know, one died, and then the other one died. And then the last one died, like since we've been back together, and then he didn't tell me about it. So I was just like, yeah, you know, the motherfucker's weird.
It's mysterious.
He's an eccentric motherfucker, and I bet he would be like, people don't like to be called weird or this or that, but he fucking is. And if he wants to say about me, that's fine too. But so just kind of learning the dynamics, you know, of like, because like I said, we weren't the same person earlier on, but we did bring our own, you know. So it's like, oh, he would do that, and I would do that, and he would do that, and I would do that.
Right.
We played to our strengths, or whatever it was. I don't even know if that's true, but that's what we did. That's how we parsed.
Right. But you learned what your strengths were in the context of having already met him, because that was the...
Yeah.
That was, you were so young, you hadn't written a song before that.
Oh, no, right? No, not at all. Yeah, I hadn't written any song. I mean, I just was like obsessed with music, you know? And yeah, I mean, he was an amazing guitar player, like at 19. That's how I met him. It was just accidental. And it wasn't meeting him. It was actually seeing him play and saying, oh, like, I've never seen anything like this weird human. Like, and I still, maybe he's always been as weird as he is now.
Yeah, probably.
So you grew up in DC or the suburbs of DC
in actual DC.
DC, like ghetto DC. But it all, I mean, I'm kind of stoked the way, you know, my parents brought me up. I mean, they let me do whatever I wanted, too.
Right. So is either of them musical? Did either of them play music?
They love music. My dad, he could sing. He could sing. They just listened to a lot of music. And they, like, I was into music so young. Like, I remember my first xylophone in Montessori school. Like, I was just like, what? So they bought me, like, a $200 busted-up piano for my 8th birthday.
Oh, nice.
So good. But I, you know, I've also got, I'm dyslexic, and I also have eye-hand coordination stuff. So it was always like kind of like like I would play, and I remember my second recital, like I guess I was 10. And I like got on stage, and I completely just like was super nervous, and then I just ad-libbed the whole thing. I don't know what I was doing. It was horrible. And it was kind of like being in a fugue state, and I could not stand being on stage. And then at like whenever I was in school, like, you know, there's Alice in Wonderland, they make you go and do this, and they like, I always got all these parts, and I never really wanted to be in any of the plays. Like, I guess I don't know. I guess there was a presence there. But I still today, like, I don't ever want to be a look at me type person. So I'm not a good front person. I'm really not. So you feel different. But I wasn't like, I mean, I like performing music. I don't like being stared at. I guess that's the thing.
So do you think that kind of not liking it that much is part of what helped build your presence, the kind of the way you occupy the stage? Is part of it is that you're
I saw The Residents when I was 15. I was like, I want to live my life in a big eyeball. Like, you know, like, I mean, how great would it be? But that's also theater. Like I feel like when I'm on stage, I do just become myself, but I'm aware of the fact that maybe that's not satisfying other people's needs, but it's satisfying mine. I need to go inward. Like, I try to put outward, but like when I'm listening, it's kind of like, you know, like that's why I wore shades for so long. I would just close my eyes so I could hear and then just like kind of get into it, you know, or just like,
or hide behind the hair.
The hair, or just kind of anything, just like so I could be just, because I didn't want like the art, you know, to be like, hey, I'm presenting something. Like, it never, I guess because being plays always, that did freak me out. I didn't like to be in the plays. Like,
is it the contrivance of it?
I guess so. I guess I'm like hyper aware and I feel like super self-conscious, like, I mean, you know, it's like, I completely overthink it. Like, other people, like people are like, people think that's great when that, and I'm like, it's all good. I definitely sabotage myself a lot, but I'm aware of it. I'm like, oh, yep.
right.
But that's like kind of what always keep, like, I'm always like, no, I gotta do this. I gotta do more.
When did you start thinking of yourself as an artist? Like, how long had you, was it before you started making music at all?
Yeah, I think, I think it's not like, oh, I'm different. But I think that I knew that other people didn't behave the same way. I'm gonna repeat, that I did early on. I just had like lots of weird, like, hang-ups. Like, you know, put me in a dress, I'll kill you, you know, but, you know, pink is the only, I will not have anything other than pink. Like my mom had to make my fucking food pink when I was, like, she would like put pink, like she would put Jell-O, like raspberry Jell-O in the milk. So I would drink my milk. Like, pink, I was upset, you know, yeah. I didn't know it at the time that these were weird, but, and that's why my parents sent me to Montessori school. And I had the OCD or whatever, because I drew pictures of Abraham Lincoln day in and day out. I mean, I think that there was a puzzle that my parents had done. It was this puzzle of Abraham Lincoln. So I watched it become on the table.
Yeah.
And then I was just obsessed. And they're like, okay, so we need to take her in for some testing. And
can you still draw Abraham Lincoln?
What?
Can you still draw Abraham
Lincoln? I haven't drawn him in a million years.
I bet you could just fucking trance your way through it.
And it was so great that was the guy that I picked. Yeah. Anyway.
So yeah, so you felt like a weird kid.
I did, but my mom was always like, but everybody wants to be your friend. You know, like, I always felt really, I did always feel a little like strange. I mean, I played basketball. I played softball. I was on the swim team. I played soccer up until I was 15 years old. I coached boys soccer after I met Neil. Like, because those were places where I could interact with other people, which kind of made me, you know, like, I know that, especially, I was bused to a school that was in a house, and there was 10 people in my class. So,
oh, wow.
No socialization, so to speak, you
know? Yeah, damn.
And I just guess I always felt different, but not like, oh, I feel horrible or bad, but I was just like, it's kind of like, you know, I guess I'm just not like that, you know? And then I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, so then did you start going to shows? Like, how old were you when you started going to shows? And where would you have just like all ages shit?
All ages shows. I started, like, my dad took me to my first all ages show, like right before I turned 11, and he would just drop me off. And I went to shows. I mean, most any, like, even by the time I was 16, you know, you didn't have to have an ID to go into, like, the old 930 Club or the old DC Space or whatever. Mm-hmm. You just got a stamp. But there was certain, you know, a lot of those shows would, you know, start at 10 or whatever, and, you know, when you're in, like, eighth grade or so. But the matinees, the Sunday matinees, that's where, God, I mean, I saw Discord, I saw, like, you know, they would come, like, Anti-Nowhere League, oh my, like, the British people, like, came over, like, and right. then I just saw so much. I mean, Bad Brains was my first, that was the first show I ever saw, and that was up in Adams Morgan. It was an all ages show. It wasn't at Madam's Organ, which was, that was a bar place. It was at this basement of some kind of some church or whatever up in Northwest.
Did you feel like when you got into that environment starting at like age 11, that as a kid who grew up feeling like, I feel a little different, did it seem like you found your zone
I still felt really weird. I did, but I just liked it. Like I was really intrigued. It's like, yeah. I was really into it. And I was like, this is kind of, I don't know. I just thought it was amazingly fascinating.
Yeah. Like, and also just like, I don't know, that kind of thing, the Sunday punk matinee thing doesn't exist anymore, but as far as I'm aware, folks, let me know if it still does somewhere. But I feel like, you know, for people who end up becoming artists, just to have access to some kind of punk rock thing, some real punk rock thing, so that you're if you're only exposed to the commercial shit, you never get grounding in the sort of like the real way to do stuff.
Yeah, you don't know where it really came from before it got put in the producer's hands or that.
Yeah,
like, you know, because that shit, it doesn't come out of the mic or the amp, like, you know, like Britney Spears, it doesn't come out that amazingly wonderfully pop.
Polished. Yeah,
yeah.
You know, you mentioned like pop things that you like, and I wonder though, are there some like young weirdos who've caught your attention lately? Who are some of the young weirdos whose music you've been appreciative of in recent years?
Unless they're weirdos on the radio, right. It's hard for me to know. And my husband actually knows a lot, like that's what he does. Like, but no, there's definitely some. I love MGMT. When those first two singles came out years back, I was like, since Nickelback, I know this sounds weird, but there was not a, like, I mean, this sounds fucked up, but really a strong radio single where you're like, oh, fuck yeah. You know? That's just like, you know, white boys with guitars and stuff. Yeah. You know, it's like, you know, different types, but I really appreciated them. And, you know, I mean, Avalanches, you know, I love that shit. Yeah. You know, I'm writing a new song for them. I was just listening to the two tracks they sang. Those guys are amazing.
Yeah, and they're such lovely,
nice dudes, people. It's kind of the way they make music is the way that I make music in my brain. I just don't have the patience to even. It's you know, like I'm just slap dash. Like, but I really appreciate what they, you know.
Yeah,
oh my God.
It's sort of like Rain Man for samples.
It really is. I mean, and listen, no, there's. God, what the fuck? I mean, there's bands. There's definitely.
MGMT is interesting because it's like, yeah, they had those fucking bangers on the first album.
Yeah.
And then they like ran away from themselves or something. I appreciate their weird shit too.
Yeah.
I like that they were like, oh shit, we got to get weirder. That was too easy. But.
Well, they're
songs are such hits.
Yeah, no.
It's like they've avoided doing that ever again.
Well, yeah. I mean, they avoided even being MGM teams. Like, it was like, you know, their parents were like, you should probably just do this, you motherfuckers.
Wow.
So, no, those guys, they're also like kind of in their heads in a good way. Like they, you know, they grapple with some of the same types of things, you know,
the self-sabotage thing at heart.
Yeah. I mean, some of the thinking people, I don't know. I mean, I don't know, but there are some that I want to be the one that can do both, but maybe when I'm 90, like, I don't know if that's ever going to happen.
I love the sound of Jennifer's bracelets jangling throughout that interview, you know? And that brings us to the end of episode 32 of LSQ. I'm Jenny LSQ. Massive thanks to Adam Green and Jennifer Herrema for their time. And big thanks to you for pressing play. In the next couple of weeks, I've got a new episode with Laura Jane Grace, followed this fall by episodes with Stephen Malkmus and Phosphorescent and Chairlift's Caroline Polachek, among others. Please subscribe if you haven't done that already. And whenever you've got questions or feedback or ideas, you can reach me on Twitter and Instagram at Jenny LSQ.